This is Solidarity Journal. Share in a common voice. Just might find your own.
To think that this was John Doe,
it's like the
argument about the arguments in
part. It's Tuesday, March 6th, and you're listening to Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Gary's one and only Pacifica radio affiliate. I'm your host, Michael Perillo. On today's show, I had the chance to sit down with Camilla Mejia, one of the first soldiers to publicly come out against the Iraq War and become a conscious objector. I talked with him about what brought him to Peoria and what made him refuse to fight and become a conscious objector. So stay tuned to Solidarity Journal on the front lines of radio resistance. Listening to Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica radio affiliate. I'm your host, Michael Perillo.
Specialist David Schaefer, Bellevue. Specialist Omar Albrecht, Chicago. Specialist James Dorsey, Beardstown.
The names being read out loud are those of U.S. soldiers from Illinois who have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan in the past 11 years. This past weekend, people from Peoria gathered outside in the cold weather on Bradley University's quad to reflect over a memorial showing the true cost of war. There were the 230 empty military boots and civilian shoes representing the men, women, and children who have been killed in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Some of those reading off the names of the dead were veterans themselves. One couple was the mother and father of Aaron Barnes, a 26-year-old soldier from Canton who had a wife and two young children. After his return home from Iraq, he had died from a very rare and extremely aggressive cancer. Parents believe that this was brought on by the depleted uranium that has been used in Iraq and Afghanistan. After all the names were recited, about 36 of us walked up to New Miller Hall and watched Soldiers of Conscience, a documentary about U.S. soldiers who publicly spoke out against the Iraq War and tried to attain conscious objector status.
You're seeing how war affects the civilians that are in the area. You know, every house you look at has got bombs, you know, craters in it or bullet holes in it. You see the young girl that stands along the side of the road with her arm burned, third-degree burns, and you want to help her, but you can't do it because you're in the middle of a war. And you see all that stuff, and you see how it affects you, and you see how it affects everyone around you, and you just say, you know what, why are we even doing this anymore?
One of the individuals in the film is Iraq veteran and conscious objector Camilla Mejia, who after being in Iraq for 5 months, refused to return and fight.
The destruction of an entire nation, nothing ever prepares you for, you know, the unmeasured killing of civilians. Nothing ever prepares you for what that does to you as a human being, you know, to kill an innocent person. Nothing's going to really prepare you for the level of destruction that you bring upon a nation and that you bring upon yourself for being a part of it. And yet, I have a conscience, you know, which goes way beyond any law. It goes way beyond any order that I could receive.
I sat down and spoke to Camilio earlier that day about what brought him to refuse to fight in the Iraq War and speak out against the lies of the U.S. and the embracing of the military-industrial complex. Mejia was Stop Loss, which is an involuntary extension of service members' active duty service under the enlistment contract in order to retain them beyond their initial end of term of service. So in May 2003, for Operation Iraqi Freedom, Camillo went from an 8-year contract under the military to an extended contract that kept him in a legally bounded by the military until 2031. So, 2 months later, before his contract would have ended, Camillo found himself participating in the invasion of Iraq.
When I arrived in Iraq in 2003, this must have been April of 2003, my original objections to the war, which had been very abstract and politically driven, became way more internal. They became way more heartfelt. It wasn't something that I was basing upon my readings of a Time magazine article or the New York Times or news, but basically things that we were seeing and doing. The first mission that we had in Iraq was at this place called Al-Asad. It was a POW camp that we were supposed to run for about a week, and where prisoners were being deprived of sleep through fear tactics that amounted to torture. And this was my welcome to Iraq mission.
At Al-Asad prison camp, Camillo witnessed things that made him question the U.S. role in Iraq. At the prison, prisoners were subjected to sleep deprivation, where soldiers would scream at the prisoners and keep them awake for 48 hours straight. On one occasion, Mejia witnessed one soldier taking a sledgehammer and banging it against the concrete wall near the prisoners who were hooded. It would frighten them into thinking that there was an explosion. In other cases of interrogation, Mejia watched a soldier once produce a 9mm, press it against one of the prisoner's temples, and pull back the pistol's receiver, making the prisoner think he was going to be executed. This was one of the many events that Camillo witnessed, the brutalizing and killing of the Iraqi people. It would get to the point of resisting and avoiding doing missions that required questioning the rationale of orders.
Well, in the beginning, I was not very willing to put my good name and my good rank on the line. I did it very shyly. I was lucky to be a squad leader. I was in charge of an infantry squad. I was in charge of anywhere between 7 and 9 men, depending on the day, and to go out on missions and be in charge of a convoy and things like that, and basically doing whatever I could in order to avoid the unnecessary loss of life. And that was one way that I was able to resist what was going on there, by making absolutely sure that we took every measure necessary to not have to fire it upon people or get fired upon. And then also questioning the rationale behind missions on the grounds that it was unsound and unsafe for our own soldiers, which was true. But of course, that by and large, the bulk of the casualties was borne by the Iraqis, not by the soldiers, not even by the combatants, but basically by people who were basically standing in the middle. So missions where it was pretty obvious that we were going out there intentionally to draw fire upon ourselves, to instigate firefights, to provoke the resistance by doing everything opposite from what we knew how to do things in the infantry, and given our experience there in country, giving away the element of surprise, you know, following the same routes every day, leaving at the same time, gathering at the same spots, just about amounted to giving the enemy a work plan, you know, saying we're going to be here, we're going to follow this route, this is at the times we're going to be there, which you don't do. You don't do that stuff in the military, not only for your own safety, but also in order to avoid unnecessary human loss. I mean, this is not a war that was being fought from trenches or in the desert. You know, this is being fought in neighborhoods and marketplaces and alleyways and places full of people, children, women, unarmed men, elderly. So basically I started questioning the rationale behind a lot of these missions. Why are we not following procedure? Why are we not using the element of surprise? And I started getting in trouble with my leadership
who began to well, first of all, they didn't like being questioned in the first place, but also who began questioning my courage, my ability to stay focused. You know, they accused me of losing my nerve because I was bringing up questions that everyone had, but no one was bringing up. But I never really, to be honest with you, I never really took a stance openly based on regard for human life. I never really said, these are human beings, we should not be killing them this way, because I was too afraid, because you don't want to come across as the guy who's soft. You don't want to come across as the guy who's sympathetic to those who are firing upon you or whatever. So I never really had the courage to take a stand for the Iraqi people while I was in country. That didn't happen until after I went through a process of self-exploration and fear, and I had to overcome a lot of moral obstacles that were standing in the way of my coming out and speaking out for peace and against what was happening in Iraq.
After returning home for a two-week leave, Camilio did some deep reflecting now that he was away from Iraq. And although he was already against the war on a political level, he started realizing that he objected to war in general.
So my political objections to the war became more principled and heartfelt and I guess you would say spirit-driven objections to not just the war in Iraq, but to the things that happen in every war, to the killing of civilians, to the brutalizing of people, to the loss of heart in this horrible environment that we call war. Eventually, I decided not to continue participating in the war effort when I came home on leave for 2 weeks. And eventually, not only choosing not to return to the war, but also eventually choosing to speak out publicly about my objections to the war, not only on political grounds, but also on grounds of the missions and the way that we were behaving towards the Iraqi people.
Conscious objector status is very difficult to get. Major Pamela Stevenson in the documentary explains how one goes about obtaining CO status.
When one applies for conscientious objector status, there is a regulation that fully guides a soldier through the process. The soldier makes a formal application to his chain of command requesting conscientious objector status. The soldier has a burden of proof. The soldier has to prove that the beliefs are genuine, that the beliefs are real, that the beliefs crystallized after the soldier came on active duty. The soldier is interviewed by the chain of command, by a chaplain, by a person through mental health, and they compile a complete application documenting their beliefs and why they think they should be a conscientious objector. An independent investigating officer is appointed, then the entire packet has to go through the chain of command and is ultimately reviewed by a board of officers at Headquarters Department of the Army. And then ultimately a decision is made whether or not the soldier is a conscientious objector.
Camilio explains a bit more of his feelings of his CO status and how powerful of a message it is to send to the military.
It's really difficult, first of all, because there isn't enough information about being a conscientious objector. It's one of the things that the military doesn't want people to know, that you actually could join the military and then develop an aversion to war. The idea is that if you're a conscientious objector, you don't join the military in the first place. So for me, after coming home from Iraq, initially, it was pretty difficult for me to accept that I could be a conscientious objector because I had been an infantry squad leader, battle tested, who had fired his weapon. And the way I viewed it, it was too late for me. I was already marked. I was already, it was too late for me to claim conscientious objection. I was already damaged. You know, I could no longer claim to be a CO. And yet, I think, I don't think there's any more powerful argument against war than the experience of being in war. But that's not something that it's understood in the military. Also, it's pretty difficult in the military for the rank and file soldier or airman or whatever to apply for CO status unless they come from one religious tradition of peace, you know, like the Quakers or the Mennonites, and two, if they're well educated and are able to articulate their objection to war, and they're able to convince the people who are involved in the process of deciding whether or not you can be a CO. So in a way, it's very classist and racist because I think that by and large, when you look at the cases of people who have actually applied for conscientious objector status and obtained conscientious objector status, by and large, they have been mostly white and college educated, particularly from the officer ranks who have actually gained CO status. So it's difficult in part because of a cultural thing in the military that, you know, you don't question war, you don't question your orders, you just do as you're told. And also in part because it's a very elitist resource.
I asked Camilio when it was that he felt in control of his life and the situation that he was in after being in Iraq.
For me, when I went to military jail, because for a long time I had been too afraid to stand up for my beliefs and for my principles and to follow my conscience and what my heart was telling me to do. Even in war, you know, truly believing that my own destiny was out of my own control, truly believing that I was not in a position where I could choose not to kill people, or I could choose not to brutalize people, or I could choose not to say no to killing, not to say no to war. And yet it wasn't until I made that choice to put everything on the line and say, I'm not going to be a part of this anymore, that I actually really, really felt empowered. And the moment when I actually went to jail and I realized that, you know, this is really happening, I'm losing my physical freedom, I'm going to some place where I'm going to be behind bars for a year, was a moment when I felt really liberated, because I was finally able to say, this is the right thing to do and this is exactly what I'm going to do. So to people who are in the military who think that they are trapped in a situation, there's no way out, they can't make that choice, they can't make that choice. That's the truth is, nobody can make that choice but ourselves. We are the only ones who can make that kind of choice to follow our conscience and to do what our heart is telling us to do. So I would encourage them, whatever it is that their conscience is telling them to do, to do just that.
Camilo talked about a couple of his fears while in Iraq.
One of my greatest fears in Iraq was, because I have a daughter and she's with me here in Peoria, who was still 2 years old at the time of my deployment. She had not turned three. And even prior to becoming a conscientious objector, I had been against the war. I had politically, the war did not make any sense to me. And when I was in Iraq, as I explained, I became more morally and spiritually opposed to the war in a real deep, profound way. And one of my greatest fears was being killed in Iraq and leaving behind that legacy to my daughter, that my father had been to this war and died for it and died in it, and for her to glorify war as a result of that. There's a picture that I had taken of myself holding give peace a chance. This was while I was pulling guard duty at a watchtower in Jordan, and this was my message to my daughter that her father, even though he had been there, had not really been in favor of the war. And that's one of that was one of my biggest fears. Another one of my biggest fears was that after engaging in the missions that we were doing in Iraq, that I had pushed away my humanity far enough to not be able to to go back to being a father, to be able to go back to being a friend, to be able to go back to being a productive member of society. I had this fear that the war had changed me in a way that I could never again live with myself. And I wouldn't say that's a fear today, but I think that the way that you negotiate that fear is by constantly living your life in a way that atones for the damage that you committed in Iraq in the war. So it's I wouldn't say something that you necessarily overcome. It's just a change that you live with, and it's something that never ends. It's something that just continues to shape who you are and to shape your actions and to shape your views.
I then asked him what he feels whenever he goes to memorials, like the one at Bradley University.
Deep sense of sadness that so much life has been wasted, so much blood has been shed, and for what? I mean, I just, to this very day, I don't really understand how there can ever be made a case for war. I do not understand how, and not just war, but violence in general. I mean, I'm never going to put myself in a position to judge those who are fighting for self-determination or who are fighting against an oppressive invading power. But when you look at war itself, when you look at combat, when we were in Iraq and we were the recipient of the resistance fighters, by and large, the people who died were those standing in the middle. It was not the soldiers, it was not the resistance fighters. When you hear a report in the news that, you know, so many people were killed in action, so many people were killed in a firefight or whatever, you got to keep in mind that 9 out of 10 people who were killed were civilians. It's just seeing that waste of human life. I don't understand how we're still, this day and age, able to somehow justify this.
Camilo has done something that most find difficult to do, and that's to stand up to the military-industrial complex and the war profiteers that send off other Americans to kill people in other countries, people who have more in common with us than those who tell us to kill them. This country has fallen to the lies and fear of war propaganda, only to come away with our brothers and sisters broken, dismembered, and dead. Camilla has shown that our conscience is the greatest thing that one can possess, and that it is the only thing that no one can take away from us.
Suddenly, you know, I say, you know, I'm not going to go to war. I'm not going to go back to that. I'm not going to go back to obey everything that I'm told, keeping my mouth shut and ignoring the fact that I have a conscience. I'm going to take a stand, and I'm going to say, no, I'm not going back to this war.
Yeah.
does it for today's show, so tune in next week on Tuesday at 6 a.m. and 2 p.m. to hear more Peoria exposés on Solidarity Journal. To listen to past shows, check out radioforall.net and search Solidarity Journal. And if you want updates on other WAZU programming, go to wazufm.org. So until next time, keep up the resistance.